Support for this podcast comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Across Iowa, hundreds of neighborhood banks are providing jobs, supporting businesses, and strengthening our communities. Here, the life you build is backed by Iowa banks. See what we mean at iowabankers.com.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up later in the hour, Kathy Obradovich of Iowa Capitol Dispatch on State Senator Liz Mathis's entry into the 1st District Congressional race. Kate Payne with an update on the Molly Tibbetts murder case. Meteorologist Jeff Zog will talk about this new statewide air quality alert. And we'll talk with Milt Kramer, leaving office as mayor of Manchester, Iowa, after, get this, nearly half a century as mayor in Manchester. But first, let's start with the latest in the pandemic, how guidance keeps evolving on how to protect ourselves against the Delta variant of this virus. New research suggesting vaccinated people can spread COVID. So the CDC now urging even vaccinated people to wear masks indoors in places with high virus transmission. Also this week, President Biden announcing that federal government workers and contractors will have to get vaccinated or submit to regular testing, social distancing, masks, and more. We're joined once again by Dr. Stanley Perlman, immunologist, microbiologist at the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics. He's studied various coronaviruses for more than 40 years, one of the world's foremost experts on coronaviruses. Dr. Perlman, thank you for being with us again.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Last time I think we spoke was mid-May. The CDC had issued new guidance then. The crux of that guidance back in May, almost more than 2 months ago, it was this: fully vaccinated people can resume activities without wearing a mask or physically distancing. Okay, now fast forward to our point and tell us, because people are really confused by this evolving messaging. From your viewpoint as a researcher, immunologist, someone very acquainted with this novel virus, is it matching up with the science? Is our understanding of this virus changing so drastically scientifically?
I'd say this Delta variant has been puzzling to me, so that's why I'd like to see some of the original data, because the stories I hear is that the virus grows 1,000 times better than the original virus, and that, as you said, people who are vaccinated can transmit the virus. That's not really that statement could be true if the virus is really 1,000 times higher, because even if you knock down the amount of virus by the vaccine 1,000-fold and you have 1,000 times more, you're back to where you started. So that's a problem. But I'd like to see the original data. I'd like to see the information saying that it's equally likely to spread the virus if you're vaccinated or not. I think we still know that people who are actually infected with the Delta virus do much better if they've been vaccinated. Mm-hmm. So that part still seems to be true.
Uh-huh. We're trying to just sort of understand this as something we perhaps already know. We are at war with this virus, we say. And as in a real war, we have to adjust to changes made by the enemy. Is this the way we're thinking? We should be thinking about this evolving, mutating virus?
Well, in some senses, yes. I think what we're learning is that if the virus can really grow better, and that's what it's probably aiming to do. The other parts I'm not sure about yet, whether it really causes more severe disease. There's reports of that, but I'm not sure that's true. But if it's evolving to be more virus there, then we have to act accordingly and make sure everybody's vaccinated and maybe go back to wearing masks, as you alluded to in your introduction.
Yeah, right. So this shedding of virus, when someone's infected, perhaps even a breakthrough virus, someone who's been vaccinated, this Delta variant, do you have a handle? Are you confident you can say how much more virus is shedded by a person with the Delta variant compared to the original variant?
Well, I've just seen this one report of there being 1,000 times more virus, and I just don't understand that as a virologist, because it sounds like so much more. Each cell cannot make 1,000 times more virus, so maybe more cells are infected. You know, the other thing to emphasize here is that these vaccines are probably not going to give sterilizing immunity, which is a complete elimination of the virus. So I don't think that was ever a realistic expectation. So I think the virus is always going to be there to some level.
Sterilizing immunity, I haven't heard that term. That would mean what? So in past inoculations, vaccinations against other diseases, we've had something that just knocks it out completely.
Yeah, that's what happens with measles. That's why people who are exposed to measles who have been vaccinated or have the natural infection don't get sick. So it's really effective. With the measles, the one thing I don't know is if there's any bit of shedding, because I don't think anyone's really looked at it very, very carefully. Mm-hmm. But certainly other vaccines, you know, the polio vaccine, we know that's good preventing polio, but we also know that the virus is still shed in the feces after vaccination. So it's a complicated business, and especially since COVID-19 virus is more like a cold virus than anything else, it seems to me unlikely we'll ever completely eliminate the virus. So what I care about is that people who are infected don't get really sick, and that the amount of virus that's shed is not enough to infect someone else. But to think that there'd be no replication, no growth of the virus in the person, plus or minus vaccination, is probably not warranted.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've heard these anecdotal cases of people, perhaps, you know, 5-6 people in a van going somewhere, all vaccinated, and after that 2-hour van ride, the majority of them come down with infections. Does that make sense to you? Is that possible?
Yep. Yeah, that makes good sense. If one person was infected, and there it even makes more sense, because even if they're vaccinated, by the same analogy I was saying early on, if there's a 1,000-fold reduction in virus, but there's still something, and then you're sitting in a van for 2 hours and the virus is floating around for those 2 hours, it's not surprising that other people can get infected. I would suspect that those people would not have had disease, or they would have had very mild disease, and which is what the vaccine is supposed to prevent. Now, the part that's more concerning is I hear stories about people who've been vaccinated, and some people get serious illness with the Delta variant, and other people still have a loss of sense of smell, probably again with the Delta variant. So there's still much that we have to learn and much we need to be wary of. The virus is doing what viruses do. Our estimation about how effective vaccines could be and what exactly would result from all this probably require some modification as we learn more information. But it's still the same old coronavirus, still doing the same kinds of things, just doing some parts of it a little better.
Right. And so, you know, some people might be those who are vaccinated. We're on to masking, though. So what do you say to those who are vaccinated and just say, hey, I'm willing to take the risk of getting mildly sick, and I don't want to wear a mask? You're risking some pretty good consequences, even though the immediate symptoms may be mild. You may not be hospitalized, right?
Yeah, that's all true. That's right. But there may be consequences of getting infected. So that's why I think that for some people, wearing a mask is very simple, because they just don't want to get infected. They don't want to deal with complications. They don't want to infect someone around them. They don't want any of those bad consequences. So they wear a mask.
Dr. Stanley Perlman with us for a few minutes on this edition of River to River. I think you're a New York Times reader. Let me just quote from their article today called COVID Mysteries. Just a few excerpts. In India, cases have plunged over the past 2 months. A similar drop may be now underway in Britain. No clear explanation for these declines. In the U.S., cases started falling rapidly in early January. The decline began before vaccination was widespread. It did not follow any evident changes in Americans' COVID attitudes. This spring, caseloads were not consistently higher in parts of the U.S. that had relaxed masking and social distancing measures, like Florida and Texas, than in regions that remained vigilant. A few other sort of parts of the mystery, according to the New York Times. Is it a mystery to you?
Yes. Yeah, it certainly is. I think this is what happened with the flu in 1918 as well, that there'd be waves. And why the waves went away, no one really knew. But this is a real mystery with this infection, yes.
Mm-hmm. Is it disorient? You've been at this a long time, studying coronaviruses for some 40 years. Is it, at this point in your career, disorienting to you as an infectious disease specialist?
No, I think the word I would use is humbling. because anytime I think I know something, it turns out I don't know it.
Mm-hmm. Okay, humbling. And what are you doing right now in your research? Is it connected in your lab to some part of conquering this or stemming this pandemic?
Yeah, well, we're still working on some antiviral therapeutics. We're still working on the loss of sense of smell, because I think that's going to be a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
Because people have that, and whether that's going to be a precursor to really bad outcomes like cognitive defects and Alzheimer's disease is something that we don't have proof for, but some people worry about. So we're interested in those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. And that loss of sense of smell, I've heard it was due to the virus causing parts of the brain having to do with sense of smell and taste, inflammation causing that, or do we know the mechanism by which that happens neurologically?
Yeah, we think it's inflammation. There's really very little evidence that, certainly very little evidence that there's infection of the nerves that are involved in the sense of smell and taste, but there may be involvement of the cells that are near the nerves, but this is still would point to inflammation being the issue, and how this is exactly working is unclear, because it's not really seen in other viral infections to the same extent.
Mm-hmm. Inflammation where? The brain, the nervous system?
Well, you think probably the nose. That's what's so curious, and maybe in the brain as well. This is still a work in progress that we don't really understand, because the simple explanation would have been that there was virus in the brain, but that's been really hard to prove.
Okay. An email from Paul. He asks, do you expect, is it expected that COVID-19 to migrate from Missouri? There's a hotspot state, right? Of course, if you look at the infection map of the U.S., Iowa is kind of in middle ground, but Missouri really a hotspot. He's asking, due to the low vaccination rate in the southernmost tiers of Iowa counties, will it spread up? Or, I know you're not an epidemiologist, but does that worry you?
Well, you know, yes, of course it worries me because it's an area of low vaccination. But, you know, just like you were saying, the virus disappears when it shouldn't be, or we don't expect it to. So who knows if it'll migrate from southwest Missouri to Iowa. One would expect it might, but until it actually does it, we don't know. You know, certainly one would hope that the people who are not vaccinated in southern Iowa would look at this and say, well, here's a virus that's maybe a little more severe, certainly more transmissible. I better get vaccinated.
Mm-hmm. In the half minute we have left, Dr. Perlman, what else do you have your eyes on now in the coming weeks as this virus changes and our understanding of it changes?
I don't know, because I'm just following how the virus is moving along, both geographically and changing in terms of its structure or in terms of its mutations. I don't know that we have any huge surprises. So, for example, we haven't seen infection of the brain or heart or anything else. We still see complications there. But the virus is still mostly a lung virus and a nose virus. That's where it's doing most of its work. So I look for all those things, but I think the epidemiology is where I'm concentrating right now.
Okay. Dr. Stanley Perlman of the University of Iowa, thank you so much for letting us check in with you again, Dr. Perlman.
Oh, my pleasure.
It's a Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, this week, State Senator Liz Mathis, a Democrat from Hiawatha, announced her bid to challenge Republican Congresswoman Ashley Hinson for Iowa's 1st District seat. In her announcement video, Mathis said her campaign came out of a concern over political conflict and Republicans like her opponent not supporting even the bipartisan committee to investigate the Capitol insurrection.
Hi, it's Liz Mathis. It's been the joy of my life to listen to your stories, be your voice, and help people who need it. But lately, what I hear from so many in Eastern Iowa is their concern about the level of conflict and where we're headed as a country, whether the people we send to Washington are putting Iowa first or just playing politics.
Okay, that was Liz Mathis in her announcement video this week. Joining me now, Kathy Obradovich, Editor-in-Chief of Iowa Capital Dispatch. Welcome back to our program, Kathy.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Here we have a matchup. If Mathis gets the Democratic nomination, this is between two former TV news anchors, both with lots of name recognition. Tell us a little bit about Liz Mathis here.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting, Ben, how similar Liz Mathis and Ashley Hinson are in their backgrounds. As you said, both of former television journalists, and they were even co-workers at one time at KCRG, which is a TV station in Cedar Rapids. Both have served in the Iowa legislature representing Linn County. Hinson was a state representative from 2017 to 2021, which is when then she, of course, had been elected to Congress. Mathis has served in the state Senate since 2011. They both are native Iowans. Mathis grew up on a farm near DeWitt. I would expect her to be talking about her farm background in her campaign. Hinson grew up in West Des Moines. And interestingly, she's a classically trained violinist, which is, something that I just recently learned about her. So
I didn't know that either.
Yeah. She actually played with the Des Moines Symphony. So, yeah, interesting. I'd like to see her play on the campaign trail sometime.
So we heard a little bit hints of the narrative from that Mathis campaign video. What do you see here as, the narrative of the Mathis campaign to unseat Hinson?
Well, you know, I think that starting off to talk about bipartisanship is something that will fit well with the district. This has been shown to be a swing district in the state. Hinson just in 2020 unseated a Democrat, Abby Finkenauer, who is now running for U.S. Senate for Chuck Grassley's seat, actually. So this is a district where voters seem to be open to considering either a Democrat or Republican, unlike some of the other parts of the state. I think that, Hinson ran hard on economic issues in 2020, especially taxes. She's already given signs that will be a major theme for her again. She's on the Appropriations Committee in the U.S. House. I think that Mathis is looking for what are some things that can be how Congress can do for people in the first district. She has a background in human resources issues, served on the Human Resources Committee in the Senate, as well as ag issues. And, frankly, ag issues a lot of times in Congress, as well as in the state legislature, a lot of those are bipartisan. So she could show some bipartisan work on some of those issues.
Mm-hmm. I have to ask how the former president's followers will figure into this race in District 1. He is, of course, not running. I ask this all because Donald Trump is still very much on the minds of GOP members of Congress. We remember Trump won Iowa by a comfortable margin over Joe Biden. We also remember Ashley Hinson's campaign video successfully defeating Abby Finkenauer. Her videos featuring Hinson side by side, pictured with then President Trump. So what do you think about what I'll just call the Trump factor here?
Yeah, well, I mean, Hinson in her election in 2020 actually outperformed President Trump in the first district when she defeated Abby Finkenauer. She won by nearly 11,000 votes, even though Democrats had a pretty hefty voter registration advantage. I could be remembered this incorrectly, but I believe President Trump did endorse Ashley Hinson. Who knows whether he will endorse in that race again. But how President Trump affects the general election and the midterms that's a broader conversation for the whole state of Iowa. I mean, he obviously won Iowa by a pretty substantial margin. I would expect that things that he says headed into the midterms will be things that Iowa voters are going to be paying attention to, many Iowa voters.
Mm-hmm. What else can you tell us about the political profile of the first district of Iowa that figures here?
Yeah, well, I think that you look at the fact, for example, that Hinson and Mathis are both from sort of the Linn County, which is the largest, certainly the largest population center of the whole district. And so that, you know, if they split that vote, that makes it even more important for any candidate to do well in the smaller towns and the rural areas. So, I mean, you would think a Republican would have an advantage there, but of course, if Mathis can make good use of the farm background that she has to connect with those voters, then maybe she can be more competitive than some of her Democratic colleagues in the rural areas.
Well, over a year before Election Day in 2022, it's hard to know what will matter most in what will undoubtedly be, you'll agree, a very competitive race, right, Kathy?
Yeah, I mean, Republicans have already held a news conference this week to attack Mathis for some business dealings that she had in her past. So clearly they are targeting her as likely the most best known candidate. Certainly she's the first to announce in this race, but, you know, treating her already as a high top contender for the nomination and going after her record. So I think it's clearly going to be a hotly contested race.
Yeah. And does what happens in this newly started U.S. House investigation of January 6th matter as we head into 2022 in this race, you think?
Well, I mean, it might matter right now. It's hard to say, you know, what will still be on voters' minds, you know, come November of 2022. Certainly that this is something that is a difficult issue as it, you know, sort of relates to, for example, support for law enforcement, you know, and the, you know, the testimony this week from police officers and Capitol Police who were under attack, I think was very high impact. But, it, you know, it's very hard to sit here in the summer of 2021 and say what is going to matter when voters are going to the polls.
Indeed. We know this to be a fact. Otherwise, we'll see what happens because it's a such fast moving terrain that we we have here on our political landscape. Kathy Obradovich, Editor-in-Chief of Iowa Capital Dispatch. Until next time, Kathy, take care.
Thanks, Ben.
And we're going to take a short break. After the break, Kate Payne on the Molly Tibbetts murder case, meteorologist Jeff Zog on this new statewide air quality alert, and I'll talk with Milt Kramer, who will be leaving office as the mayor of Manchester, Iowa, after, get this, 47 years. So stay tuned. A short break, and then your news buzz on this Friday continues. I'm Ben Kiefer. Back in just a moment.
Support for this podcast comes from the Iowa Bankers Association. Across Iowa, hundreds of neighborhood banks are providing jobs, supporting businesses, and strengthening our communities. Here, the life you build is backed by Iowa banks. See what we mean at iowabankers.com.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back with more of this news buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week, the man convicted of killing University of Iowa student Molly Tibbetts, that was in 2018, Christian Behena Rivera. He was back in Poweshiek County Court on Tuesday, asking for another trial. This after new evidence surfaced related to Tibbetts' disappearance. Kate Payne has been covering it for Iowa Public Radio. Hello, Kate.
Hi.
It was back in May that the jury found Behena Rivera guilty of first-degree murder in Tibbetts' killing, but his sentencing has been delayed while this motion for a new trial plays out. What's the new testimony being considered by the judge?
Right. So these motions focus on two witnesses who came forward during the trial, actually, after they heard Bejena Rivera take the stand in his own defense. And as a reminder, it was during the trial that Bejena Rivera said publicly for the first time that it was two masked men who abducted him and forced him to drive them around as they kidnapped and killed Tibbetts and put her body in his trunk. And that's quite different than what he initially told investigators when he led them to Tibbetts' body in August of 2018. Bejena Rivera had said that he acted alone in following her on the road and that he then blacked out. But the defense argues that these two new witnesses who came forward back up his account of these other individuals. And two people independently came forward to name the same person, Gavin Jones, who they say confessed to killing Tibbetts. And we heard from one of those individuals this week.
Mm-hmm. And how would they know that? How would they know that supposedly Jones claimed this murder?
The witness that we heard from in court this week was a man named Arnie Mackey, and he was held in the same jail as Gavin Jones and said that over time, Jones confided in him and told him this account. The other individual had previously been in a relationship with Gavin Jones and also told the defense that Jones confessed to Tippett's murder. But from the court testimony from Arnie Mackey this week, according to Mackey, Jones was involved in a sex trafficking ring in the area and was going to these so-called trap houses. And it was at one of these houses that he said he saw Tibbetts bound and gagged and that a lead sex trafficker ordered him to kill her and to frame a Hispanic man for her death. Mackey testified in court that he initially did not believe this story until he heard Bejena Rivera's testimony in court. And Mackey said that his conscience compelled him to share this account, even if it wasn't true.
After hearing these alternative scenarios there, what did prosecutors make of it? How did they react?
Well, prosecutors have dismissed basically all of these arguments. They maintain that Bejena Rivera killed Molly Tibbetts, that he acted alone. They believe that Bejena Rivera's initial testimony to investigators is what happened. And investigators say that they've corroborated those statements through other evidence that they've collected, including surveillance video, through DNA testing. They stand by the case that they initially made and that they got a unanimous jury verdict on. We heard numerous times in the hearing this week when prosecutors were, you know, trying to object to this testimony, this new evidence, saying that it has no relevance to the case and trying to stop this from going forward.
Nevertheless, from your reporting, I understand the defense questioned why the investigators didn't submit more DNA profiles for testing.
That's right. So Bejena Rivera's DNA profile was the only one that was submitted for testing to the state lab. And that's despite the fact that analysts did identify other profiles in the trunk of Bejena Rivera's car. So they were able to place Bejena Rivera's DNA there, Molly Tibbetts' DNA there. But there are also two other individuals who had DNA in the trunk that they weren't able to identify because no other profiles were submitted. Now, of course, you know, DNA undisturbed can last for a very long period of time. Those profiles may not have been related to the crime at all, but the defense certainly wanted to see other potential suspects related to the case compared to that profile to see if there could have been other involvement.
So this delay in sentencing, what happens next? What did the district judge, Joel Yates, seem to make of the alternative story and the way he wants to proceed?
So Judge Joel Yates has a good poker face, so was pretty hard to read as far as his facial expressions. But he did give some indication of his thinking during the hearing. You know, prosecutors, again, made multiple objections to witness testimony, saying, how is this relevant? They also thought that some of the testimony was getting too close to the open investigation of the disappearance of Xavier Harrelson. The defense is trying to establish connections to the disappearance of that 11-year-old boy as well. He went missing from Poweshiek County in May, the same county where Tibbetts disappeared, and the defense is trying to establish connections there that the disappearances may be related. But Judge Yates said, you know, repeatedly he seemed to go out of his way to give the defense the benefit of the doubt to allow some of this testimony to continue, though he certainly understood the prosecution's complaints. But there were also multiple times that Judge Yates told the defense he didn't see the relevance of bringing up this other case of Xavier Harrelson, telling the defense that they were spending more time on him than on their own client and telling them to get to the point.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we'll see what the judge does, and we'll look forward to your reporting, further reporting on this. Kate Payne talking about the Molly Tibbetts murder case, new evidence, delaying the sentencing while this motion for a new trial plays out. Kate Payne, IPR reporter. Thank you, Kate.
Thanks.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile.
And I knew. Well, I sang along to this tune so often in my youth. Perhaps you did too. American Pie by Don McLean. It was one of the year's top new singles, a year that Milt Kramer was early in his career serving in city government in the northeast Iowa community of Manchester, 1972. Richard Nixon, Henry Kissinger were Time Magazine's Men of the Year. The Watergate scandal had just started. Waterloo native wrestler Dan Gable took home gold from the Summer Olympics that year in Munich. The average income, just over $10,000. A gallon of gas, around 50 cents. The world population, about half of what it is today. Now in 2021, after serving as Manchester's mayor for nearly half a century, Milt Kramer has decided to retire. He joins us now. Mayor Kramer, welcome to the program.
Thank you for inviting me to your program. I look forward to it.
You've led the community of Manchester for nearly half a century. You've certainly earned retirement, but I have to ask, why retire now?
Well, I think the main reason being, you know, I'm getting in an advanced age. I will be 85 on my next birthday, and all good things have to come to an end sometime, and I've decided that now is the time for me to move on to other things.
All right. I just looked you up on the internet. You are the second longest-serving mayor currently in the U.S. There's a mayor in Lake George, New York, who is just ahead of you at about 50 years.
Somebody told me that yesterday. City, it's got a population of about 3,000.
Lake George, I'm not familiar with it, but that sounds right.
I'm not either.
Can you tell us what the chief concerns of Manchester were in the early 70s? What do you remember about that time?
In the 70s, you know, looking ahead to the growth of Manchester, we really didn't have a lot of available jobs. We didn't have a lot of industry. We had a plant called Henderson Manufacturing. That was about the only one. So we developed an industrial park, and we have about 5-6 industries in it right now. Our biggest issue, and this is true of, I think, cities not only in Iowa but in the United States, is housing. We need housing. And luckily, we've got several builders in Manchester that are building condos and building houses and working on housing development. But we still need a lot of housing. And you know, people don't realize that back in the 70s, a typical home probably contained mom, dad, two, three, four kids or more, and you drive up and down our streets in Iowa now, and you've got a lot of homes that have maybe only one person in it. Maybe once in a while, too, but there just aren't that many people in these homes.
Right. Tell me, in all the years that you've been mayor, what will you look back on as being most proud of as an accomplishment?
I think the development of the industrial park. We've had a tremendous program with street development. All of our streets are hard surfaced. And we have a program that's ongoing every year. We spend about $1 million, which is a lot of money for a city our size, $1 million just in street development.
Mm-hmm. What will you miss most about being mayor of Manchester?
Oh, I think the people. I have a lot of good friends. You know, having been a school teacher, I have people that I'm still around. In fact, as my city clerk, I had as a student, my deputy city clerk I had as a student, and the list goes on and on. Over the years, I've had 11 different students serve on the city council.
Former students. Wow.
Former students. I frequent the schools quite a bit. I have an open invitation to attend the public schools and the parochial schools in Manchester, and I go in and I visit with the kids, I eat lunch with the kids, I socialize with the kids, and I'm looking at kids who I had their parents as students, and in some instances, their grandparents. So I'm still very involved with people.
And it sounds like you're going to continue being involved with your community. Goodbye for now, Mayor Kramer. I perhaps misspoke at the beginning. You're not retiring, actually. It's that you're not seeking re-election, right?
Correct.
Right. And so you're mayor until when?
The end of this year, December 31st, 2021.
Okay. Enjoy your last months as mayor. Mayor Milt Kramer of Manchester, mayor for 47 years. Thank you so much, sir.
Okay, thank you. And if you need anything else, feel free to call me.
It's your Friday News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, now joined by Jeff Zog. Jeff is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Des Moines. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, Ben. How are you today?
I'm fine. I just want to ask you about a couple things before we end our program today. Before we talk about the weather in the conventional sense, the heat we've been having, we've got a little break, but tell us about the air quality alert that was just issued.
Yes, on Thursday, we issued an air quality alert, and that was in conjunction with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. They're the ones that drive that in Iowa, and they contacted us and requested that we issue the air quality alert for the entire state because of the smoke from the wildfires out west and in Canada that was expected to overspread the state beginning on Thursday and then continuing into Thursday night and then continuing through today on Friday.
Mm-hmm. I was watching over the last couple of weeks the smoke maps across North America, and up to now, it looked like we had been able to avoid some of the big paths of smoke. They were going to the north of us?
That's correct. Most of the smoke was staying to the north in the Dakotas and Minnesota. However, just with the change in the air currents, it was starting to push it south into Iowa, which necessitated the air quality alert.
Yeah. Okay. So what does the alert mean for us? We limit outdoor activity. What should we be cautious about?
Yes, in this particular case with the air quality alert due to the smoke, one of the things is reduced visibilities in some locations, but the big thing is the impact on sensitive groups. The smoke is considered unhealthy for those sensitive groups, and those sensitive groups include the elderly, those with respiratory or heart disease, and also children. And the Iowa Department of Natural Resources just recommends that in individuals in those sensitive groups, they limit prolonged outdoor exertion and exposure to that smoke until the air quality conditions improve.
Okay. Let's talk about the conventional weather, the heat we've been having, and of course this continued drought. How normal is this heat and lack of rain at this time of year?
The heat is not unusual for this time of year. Pretty much every summer we'll have some pretty hot temperatures, and of course the summer is no exception. And this time of year, when you have the heat, you usually have the humidity too, just with the really high moisture content of the air. So that pushes heat index values even higher. And on Wednesday, for example, our hottest day of the week, we had heat index values exceeding 100 in most locations in the state. They were in the 100 to 110 range. And as for the drought conditions, you know, sometimes some summers are wet, some are dry. But obviously this summer has been pretty dry for most of the state, especially western and northern and also central parts of the state. And that's been a continuation from what we saw even last year, some dry conditions and the snow that we received during the winter, although it was welcome. Not a lot of content as far as moisture-wise to that snow, so it didn't help the drought a whole lot. And those dry conditions have just continued into the summer as we speak right now.
Mm-hmm. Okay, give us a forecast, if you could, for the weekend. It's cooled off a little bit here on Friday. Can we look forward to cooler weather, or we get back in the oven again?
Well, in the short term, what's happening is a cold front is sweeping south across the state slowly, so it's bringing those cooler temperatures that you mentioned. And those cooler temperatures will continue for today with high temperatures across the state and generally in the 80s. Chances for showers and storms actually return tonight. They'll start maybe this afternoon across some parts of the state, but then overspread the state overnight into Saturday morning. And some of those storms might be strong or severe, could produce some locally heavy rainfall, which, of course, is welcome as long as it's not too heavy, and then they move out on Saturday. Saturday night be mostly quiet across the state. And then temperatures into the early part of next week will generally be in the 80s. So we're not looking for a return to the kind of conditions we saw on Wednesday with temperatures in the 90s and really high humidity. It'll be more of kind of more like a typical summer type pattern.
Okay, very good. Jeff Zog, meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Des Moines. Always good to talk with you. Thanks, Jeff.
Thanks for having me, Ben.
Well, Friday News Buzz, like a fast-paced race through so many news conversations on our Fridays. At the end, though, we do get to shift gears, grooving into the weekend. Tony Daner of Iowa Public Radio Studio 1 to help us shift down, slow down, and relax. Tony, hi. Great to have you on.
Hey, Ben. Glad to be here.
What do you got for us?
So a bit of a disaster theme today, actually. Didn't plan that, but here we are. So our first selection is from Naya Izumi, who is a past winner of the NPR Tiny Desk Contest, kind of what he's best known for. His debut major label album is out today. It's called A Residency in the Los Angeles Area. And this first single is just really good. I don't have a lot to say about it, so let's listen. This is Naya Izumi with Natural Disaster.
Can't lay up the risk, planned it out from start to end. Thought that I had seen it all, yet something showed up and brought me down. Every time I put it all inside my eyes, I never got to lay someone down. It might look similar to what I sing, yeah, this behavior could mend the wound. No matter what we do, it's never predictable. Hello, natural disaster.
Well, Tony, I think in terms of lyrics, all I got was natural disaster. But
yeah,
I'm tapping my foot like crazy.
Oh, it's so
wonderful.
Good. Yeah, I love it this song.
It is so good and so intricate there, too. We have time for one more, Tony. What do you got for us?
Okay, so here's a song I haven't been able to stop thinking about since the first time I heard it. It's from the Felice Brothers. They have been at it for a long time. They've got a new record coming in September, but we have got the first single now. And this is a really, there's a lot of dark humor in this song, Ben. This song is about, like, staring the apocalypse in the face and, in the wake of things like air quality and crazy temperature swings and everything else, sometimes all you can do is just laugh. So let's hear it. The Felice Brothers with Jazz on the Autobahn.
The sheriff disappeared. He drove in a doomed Corvette. Helen was in the passenger seat, eating melon and spitting out the seeds, feeling happy to be alone, but still turning a saxophone as cold as stone, kind of like. What the apocalypse will look like. Tornado with human eyes. Poison bird baths and torrents of chemical rain, like the heads of state hyperventilating in clouds of methane. Sundown on the human heart.
Okay. I know it's all in good fun and good music, but it's kind of hard to listen to, Tony. Thanks
but
for grooving.
But I'm still dancing.
Me too, Tony. Tony Daner, IPR Studio One Tracks host, along with Mark Simmet and CC Mitchell. Thanks, Tony.
Thanks, Ben.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
River to River, produced today by Rick Brewer, Catherine Perkins, our executive producer. I'm Ben Kiefer. Have a wonderful weekend.
It'll sound like jazz.